Joe stuck his head around the door. Hey, Davy, cut it short, will you? Time to go. I have to go now, Ella. Thanks for everything. Goodbye, David, she said. And even over the scratchy connection, he could hear the compassion in her tone. It heightened the black anger that gripped him as he rode beside Joe to the Mirage bunker. For the first time ever, David felt uncomfortable in the cockpit of a Mirage. He felt trapped and restless, sweating and angry, and it seemed hours between each of the 15-minute readiness checks. His ground crew were playing backgammon on the concrete floor below him, and he could see them laughing and joshing each other. It made him angrier than ever to see others happy. Tubby, he barked into his microphone, and his voice was repeated by the overhead loudspeakers. The plump, serious young man who was chief engineer for Lance Squadron climbed quickly up beside his cockpit and peered anxiously through the canopy at him. There's dirt on my screen, David snapped at him. How the hell do you expect me to pick up a MiG when I'm looking through a screen that you ate your bloody breakfast off? The cause of David's distress was a speck of carbon that marred the glistening perfection of his canopy. Tubby himself had supervised the polishing and buffing of it, and the carbon speck was wind-carried since then. Carefully, he removed the offending spot, and lovingly, he polished the place where it had been with a chamois leather. The reprimand had been public and unfair, very unlike their top boy, Davy. However, they all made allowances for red standby nerves, and spots on a canopy played hell with a pilot's nerves. Every time it caught his eye, it looked exactly like a pouncing MiG. That's better, David gruffed at him, fully aware that he'd been grossly unfair. Tubby grinned and gave him a high sign as he climbed down. At that moment, there was a click and throb in his earphones and the distinctive voice of the brig. Red standby, go, go. Under full reheat and with the driving thrust of the afterburners hurling him aloft, David called, Hello, Desert Flower, Bright Lance, airborne and climbing. Hello, David, this is the brig. We have a contact shaping up for intrusion into our airspace. It looks like another teaser from the Syrians. They're closing our border at 26,000 and should be hostile in approximately 3 minutes. We are going to initiate attack plan Gideon. Your new heading is 42 degrees, and I want you right down on the deck. David acted and immediately rotated the Mirage's nose downwards. Plan Gideon called for a low-level stalk so that the ground clutter would obscure the enemy radar and conceal their approach until such time as they were in position to storm climb up into an attack vector above and behind the target. They dropped to within feet of the ground, lifting and falling over the undulating hills, so low that the herds of black Persian sheep scattered beneath them as they shrieked eastwards towards the Jordan. Hello, Bright Lance, this is Desert Flower. We are not tracking you. Good, thought David. Then neither is the enemy. Target is now hostile in sector, the brig gave the coordinates. Scan for your own contact. Almost immediately, Joe's voice came in. Leader, this is two, I have contact. David dropped his eyes to his own radar screen and manipulated his scan as Joe called range and bearing. It was a dangerous distraction when flying in the sticky phase of high subsonic drag at 0 feet, and his own screen was clear of contact. They raced onwards for many more seconds before David picked up the faint luminous fuzz at the extreme range of his set. Contact firming. Range figures 9.6 nautical miles. Parallel heading and track. Altitude 25,500 feet. David felt the first familiar tingle and slither of his anger and hatred, like the cold of a great snake uncoiling in his belly. Beseda 2, lock to target and go to interception speed. They went supersonic, and David looked up ahead at the crests of the thunderheads that reared up from the solid banks of cumulonimbus lower down. These mountainous upthrusts of silver and pale blue were sculptured into wonderful shapes that teased the imagination. Towers and turrets, embattled and emblazoned, heroic human shapes standing proud or hunched in the attitude of mourning, the rearing horsemen of the chessboard, a great fleecy pack of wolves and other animal shapes of fantasy, with the deep crevasses between them bridged in splendor by the rainbows. There were hundreds of these, great blazes of color that turned and followed their progress across the sky, keeping majestic station upon them. Above them, the sky was a dark, unnatural blue, dappled like a Windsor grey by the thin striation of the cirrocumulus, and the sunlight poured down to shimmer upon the two speeding warplanes. As yet, there was no sight of the target. It was up there somewhere amongst the cloud mountains. He looked back at his radar screen. He had taken his radar out of scan and locked it into the target, and now, as they closed rapidly, he could appraise their relative positions. The target was flying parallel to them, 20 miles out on their starboard side, and it was high above them and moving at a little more than half their speed. The sun was beyond the target, just short of its zenith, and David calculated his approach path to bring him into an attack vector from above and into the target's starboard quarter. "Turning to starboard now," he warned Joe, and they came around together, crossing the target's rear to put themselves in the sun. Joe was calling the range and bearing. It showed a leisurely patrol pattern. There was no indication as yet that the target was aware of the hunters behind and far below. "Two, this is Leader. Arm your circuits." Without taking his eyes from the radar screen, David pressed the master switch on his weapon console. He activated the two air-to-air Sidewinder missiles that hung under each wingtip, and immediately heard the soft electronic tone cycling in his earphones. That tone indicated that the missiles were dormant. They had not yet detected an infrared source to excite them. When they did, they would increase the volume and rate of cycle, growling with anticipation, clamoring like hunting dogs on the leash. He tuned them down so that he could no longer hear them. Now he selected his cannon switch, readying the twin 30mm weapons in their pods just below his seat. The trigger flicked forward out of its recess in the head of the joystick, and he curled his forefinger about it to familiarize himself with the feel of it. "Two, this is Leader. I'm commencing visual." It was a warning to Joe to concentrate all his attention on the screen and feed David with directional data. "Target is now 10 o'clock high, range figures 27 nautical miles." David searched carefully, raking the billowing walls of blinding white, breaking off the search to look away at the ground point or a pinnacle of cloud to prevent his eyes focusing short, and to sweep the blind spot behind them, lest the hunters become the hunted. Then he saw them. There were 5 of them, and they appeared suddenly out of a cloud high above and were immediately outlined against it like tiny black fleas on a newly ironed bedsheet. Just then Joe called the range again. "Figures 13 nautical miles," but the targets were outlined so crisply against their background that David could make out the delta-winged dart shape and the high tailplane that identified them beyond all doubt as MiG-21J. "I have target visual," he told Joe. 5 MiG-21s J. His tone was flat and neutral, but it was a lie. For now, at last, his anger had something on which to fasten, and it changed its shape and color. It was no longer black and aching, but cold and bright and keen as a rapier's blade. "Target is still hostile," Joe confirmed that they were within Israeli territory, but his tone was not as well guarded as David's. David could detect the huskiness in it, and he knew that Joe was feeling that anger also. It would be another 15 seconds before they had completed their turn across the enemy's stern, and David assessed the relative positions and saw that so far it had been a perfect approach. The formation sailed on serenely, unaware of the enemy beneath their tail, creeping up in the blind spot, where the forward scanning radar could not discover them, and rapidly moving into a position up sun. Once there, David would go to attack speed and climb steeply up into a position of superior height and tactical advantage over the enemy formation. Looking ahead now, he realized that chance had given them an added bonus. One of the huge tower blocks of cloud was perfectly placed to screen his climb into the sun. He would use it to cover his stalk, the way the Boer huntsmen of Africa stalked wild buffalo from behind a herd of domestic oxen. "Target is altering course to starboard," Joan warned him. The MiGs were turning away, edging back towards the Syrian border. They had completed their taunting gesture. They had flaunted the colors of Islam in the face of the infidel, and were making for safety. David felt the blade of anger in his guts burn colder, sting sharper, and with an effort of restraint he waited out the last few seconds before making his climb. The moment came, and his voice was still flat and without passion as he called to Joe. Two, this is Leader, commencing storm climb. Two, conforming. David eased back on the controls, and they went up in a climb so vicious that it seemed to tear their bowels from their bellies. Almost immediately, Desert Flower picked up the radar images as they emerged from the ground clutter. Hello, both units, Bright Lance. We are now tracking you. Show friend or foe. Both David and Joe were lying on their backs in the thrust of storm climb, but at the order, they punched in their IFF systems. Identification, friend or foe, would show a distinctive pattern, a bright halo around their radar images on command plot, identifying them positively even while they were locked with the enemy in the close proximity of the dogfight. Beseder, we are tracking you in IFF, said the brig, and they went plunging into the pillar of cloud and raked upwards through it. David's eyes darted between the boule that contained his blind flying instruments and the radar screen on which the enemy images shone bright and with hard outline. So close now that the individual aircraft in the enemy formation stood out clearly. Target is increasing speed and tightening starboard turn, Joe intoned, and David compensated for the enemy's maneuver. David was certain that they had not detected his approach. The turn away was coincidental. Another glance at the screen showed that he had achieved his height advantage. He was now 2 miles off their quarter above them, with the sun at his back. It was the ideal approach. Turning now into final leg of attack pattern, he alerted Joe to his intention, and they began the pitch-in. The last second strike, which would send their speed rocketing as they closed. The target centered dead ahead, and the gun sight lit up, glowing softly on the screen ahead of him. The Sidewinder missiles caught the first faint emanations of infrared rays from their victims, and they began to growl softly in David's earphones. Still blinded by thick grey cloud, they raced in, and suddenly they burst out into the clear. Ahead and below them opened a deep trough of space, a valley between cloud ranges, and close below them, the five MiGs sparkled silvery in the sunlight, pretty and toy-like, their red, white, and green markings festive and gay, the clean geometrical sweeps of wing and tail nicely balanced, and the shark-like mouths of the jet intakes gaping as they sucked in air. They were in a loose V formation, two stacked back on each flank of the leader, and in the fleeting seconds that David had to study them, he had assessed them. The four wingmen were Syrians. There was an indefinable sloppiness in their flying, a looseness of control. They flew with that lack of polish and confidence of the pupil. They were soft targets, easy pickings. However, it did not need the three rings about the leader's fuselage to identify him as a Russian instructor. Some leery old veteran with hawk's blood in his veins, tough and canny and dangerous as an angry black mamba. Engage two port targets, David ordered Joe, reserving the MiG leader and the starboard echelon for his attack. In David's headphones, the missiles were growling their anxiety. They had sniffed out the mass jet blasts below them, and already they were tracking, howling their eagerness to kill. David switched to command net. Hello, Desert Fox, this is Bright Lance on target and requesting strike. Almost instantly, the voice came back. David, this is the brig. He was speaking rapidly, urgently. Discontinue attack pattern. I repeat, disengage target. They are no longer hostile. Break off attack. Shocked by the command, David glanced down the deep valley of cloud and saw the long brown valley of the Jordan falling away behind them. They had crossed over a line on the earth, and immediately their roles had changed from defender to aggressor. But they were closing the target rapidly. It was a fair bounce. They were still unaware. We're going to hit them, David made the decision through the cold, bright thing that burned within him, and he closed command net and spoke to Joe. Two, this is leader attacking. Negative. I say again negative, Joe called urgently. Target is no longer hostile. Remember, Hannah, David shouted into his mask. Conform to me. And he curled his finger about the trigger and touched left rudder, yawing fractionally to bring the nearest MiG into the field of his sights. It seemed to balloon in size as he shrieked towards it. There was a heartbeat of silence from Joe, and then his voice strangled and rough. Two conforming. Kill them, Joe, David yelled, and pressed against the spring-loaded tension of the trigger. There was a soft double hiss, hardly discernible above the jet din, and from under each wingtip the missiles unleashed. They skidded and twisted as they aligned themselves on the targets, leaving darkly etched trails of vapor across David's front, and at that moment the MiGs became aware. At a shouted warning from their leader, the entire formation burst into its five separate parts, splintering silvery swift like a shoal of sardines before the driving charge of the Barracuda. The rearmost Syrian was slow. He had only just begun to turn away when one of the sidewinders flicked its tail, followed his turn, and united with him in an embrace of death. The shockwave of the explosion jarred David's machine, but the sound of it was muted as the MiG was enveloped in the greenish-tinted cloud of the strike, and it shattered into fragments. A wing snapped off and went whirling high, and the brief blooming flower of smoke blew swiftly past David's head. The second missile had chosen the machine with the red rings, the formation leader. But the Russian had reacted so swiftly and pulled his turn so tightly that the missile slid past him in an overshoot, and it lost the scent, unable to follow the MiG round. As David hauled the Mirage round after the Russian, he saw the missile destroy itself in a burst of greenish smoke far out across the valley of clouds. The Russian was in a hard right-hand turn, and David followed him. Staring across the imaginary circle that separated them, he could see every detail of the enemy machine, the scarlet helmet of the pilot, the gaudy colors of its roundels, the squiggle of Arabic script that was its identification markings, even the individual rivets that stitched the polished metal skin of the MiG. David pulled back with all his strength against his joystick, for gravity was tightening the loading of his controls, opposing his efforts to place additional stress on the Mirage, lest he tear its wings off the fuselage. Gravity had hold of David also. Its insidious force sucked the blood away from his brain so that his vision dimmed, the color of the enemy pilot's helmet faded to dull brown, and David felt himself crushed down into his seat. About his waist and legs, his G-suit tightened its coils, squeezing brutally like a hungry python, attempting to prevent the drainage of blood from his upper torso. David tensed every muscle in his body, straining to resist the loss of blood, and he took the Mirage up in a sliding, soaring yo-yo up the side of an imaginary barrel. Like a motorcyclist on a wall of death, he whirled aloft, trying once more for the advantage of height. His vision narrowed, grayed out, until his field was reduced to the limits of his cockpit, and he was pinned heavily to his seat, his mouth sagging open, his eyelids dragging downwards. The effort of holding his right hand on the control column was Herculean. In the corner of his vision, the stall indicator blinked its little eye at him, changing from amber to red, warning him that he was on the verge of catastrophe, courting the disaster of supersonic stall. David filled his lungs and screamed with all his strength, his own voice echoing through the gray mist. The effort forced a little blood back to his brain, and his vision cleared briefly, enough to let him see that the MiG had anticipated his yo-yo and had come up under him, sliding up the wall of death towards his unprotected flank and belly. David had no alternative but to break out of the turn before the MiG's cannons could bear. He rolled the Mirage out and went instantly into a tight-climbing left-hander, his afterburners still thundering at full power, consuming fuel at a prodigious rate and placing a limit upon these desperate manoeuvres. Neatly and gracefully as a ballet dancer, the Russian followed him out of the turn and locked into his next manoeuvre. David saw him coming up into an attack position in his rearview mirror, and he rolled out again and went up and right, blacking out with the rate of turn. Roll and turn, turn for life. David had judged the Russian fairly. He was a deadly opponent, quick and hard, anticipating each of David's turns and twists, riding always within an ace of strike, turn and turn again, in great winging parabolas, climbing always, turning always, vapor trails spinning out from their wingtips in silky arabesque patterns against the hard blue of the sky. David's arms and shoulders ached as he fought the control dampers and the weight of gravity, sickened by the drainage of blood and the adrenaline in his system. His cold battle rage turned gradually to icy despair as each of his efforts to dislodge the Russian were met and countered, and always the gaping shark's maw of the MiG hung and twisted a point off his shoulder or belly. All David's expertise, all the brilliance of his natural flying gifts, was slowly being discounted by the store of combat experience upon which his enemy could draw. At one stage, when for an instant they flew wingtip to wingtip, David glanced across the gap and saw the man's face. Just the eyes and forehead above the oxygen mask. The skin was pale as bone, and the eyes were deeply socketed like those of a skull. And then David was turning again, turning and screaming and straining against gravity, screaming also against the first enfolding coils of fear. He rolled half out of the turn, and then, without conscious thought, reversed the roll. The Mirage shuddered with protest, and his speed bled off. The Russian saw it and came down on him from high on his starboard quarter. As David pushed the stick fully forward and left, he kicked on full left rudder, ducking under the blast of cannon fire, and the Mirage went down in a spiraling dive. The blood which gravity had sucked from his head was now flung upwards through his body, filling his head and his vision with bright redness, the red out of inverted gravitational force. A vein in his nose popped under the pressure, and suddenly his oxygen mask was filled with a flood of warm, choking blood. The Russian was after him, following him into the dive, lining him up for his second burst. David screamed with the metallic, salty taste of blood in his mouth and hauled back on the stick with all his strength. The nose came up and over, climbing out of the dive, and again the blood drained from his head, going from red out to black out in the fraction of a second, and he saw the Russian following him up, drawn by the ploy. At the top, David kicked it out in a breakaway roll. It caught the Russian. He was 1/100 of a second slow in countering, and he swung giddily through David's gun sight, an almost impossible deflection shot that sluiced cannon fire wildly across the sky, spraying it like water from a garden hose. The MiG was in David's sights for perhaps 1/10 of a second, but in that time David saw a flash of light, a bright wink of it below the pilot's canopy, and then David rolled and turned out, coming around hard and finding the Russian still hanging in the circuit, but losing airspace, swaying out with a feather of white vapor streaming back from below his cockpit canopy. "I've hit him," David exulted, and his fear was gone, become anger again, a fierce, triumphant anger. He took the Mirage up in another soaring yo-yo, and this time the MiG could not hold the station on him, and David flick-rolled off the top and came out with the Russian centered in his gun sight. He fired a one-second burst and saw the incendiary shells lace in and burst in quick little stabbing stars in the silver fuselage of the MiG. The Russian came out of his turn in a gentle dive, flying straight, no longer taking evasive action, probably dead at his controls, and David sat on his tail and settled the pipper of his gun sight. He fired another one-second burst, and the MiG began to break up. Small, unidentifiable pieces of wreckage flew back at David, but the Russian stayed with his machine. Again, David hit him with a two-second burst, and now the MiG's nose sank until she was in a vertical dive still under full power, and she went down like a silver javelin. David could not follow her without tearing off his own wings. He pulled out and watched the Russian fly into the earth at a speed that must have exceeded Mach 2. He burst like a bomb in a tall tower of dust and smoke that stood for long seconds on the brown plains of Syria. David shut down his afterburners and looked to his fuel gauges. They were all showing only a narrow strip above the empty notch, and David realized that the last screaming dive after the MiG had taken him down to an altitude of 5,000. He was over enemy territory and too low, much too low. Expending precious fuel, he came around on a westerly heading and went to interception speed, climbing swiftly out of range of flak and searching the heavens about him for sign of either Joe or the other MiGs, although he guessed that the Syrians were either with Allah in the garden of the Huris or back home with Mother by this time.